This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I am a laboratory-based medical oncologist, and what I'm charged to talk to you guys all this morning about is genetics and genomics and the implications for prostate cancer care. So I know it's a little bit early, but I wanted to just briefly, just so we're all on the same page, briefly remind everyone about DNA, RNA, and protein. So cancer cells, just like every single cell in our body, is made up of these three basic, what we call macromolecules or biological macromolecules. These are the instructions that our cells have to function, to make machines in our cells, to do all sorts of different functions that our body requires. Okay. And so the DNA sequence is the sequence of A, T, G's, and C's, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, that are the instruction books for what our cells should be making and how they should be functioning. And essentially in cancer, what happens is that these particular instructions get sort of messed up, okay? And that the genes that encode for proteins that, for example, might be important proliferation might get turned on too high. And so the cells continue to proliferate out of control. And at the same time, we also know that there's genes that stop cells from proliferating, that make them die in our cells, in our bodies. And those genes might be turned down too low. Okay. And so what we're trying to do is really to understand what are the changes in the cancer cells at the DNA level, at the messenger RNA level, and at the protein level, to try to figure out how to best treat and understand the progression of prostate cancer. So that's what I mean by understanding cancer genetics and cancer genomics. Now, we also have increasing, this is what we call the central dogma in biology. We also know that the DNA is actually not just a string of letters that is inside our cells, but actually is wrapped around these proteins called histones, which are actually really important to determine the accessibility of the DNA to be read. Okay. So how do we use genetics and genomics to affect prostate cancer care? I'm going to talk to you guys a little bit about three main ways that it impacts your care. The first is that we're trying to identify genes that might put a patient and your family at risk for developing prostate cancer or even potentially other types of cancers. So Dr. Washington mentioned this really briefly in terms of how do we do a better job in terms of early detection and screening. So I'll give you an example of that. The second example, which we also alluded to in Dr. Washington's talk, is genomic testing to try to understand in patients with localized disease, this Decipher test, who might have more indolent disease that can be safely actively surveyed, and who might have more aggressive disease that needs treatment right away. So I oftentimes say that we're trying to separate the kittens from the tigers, right? So who needs to have treatment right away and who can be safely watched? And finally, applying genomic testing to determine the best next treatment for the patient. So I oftentimes say this is trying to use that information, the DNA, RNA, and the protein information, to try to identify an Achilles heel in each cancer so that we can better target the cancer. So one of the main things that we've been doing here at UCSF that Dr. Small alluded to is doing a lot of research to actually first define what are those changes that happen at the DNA, RNA, and protein level to define what is the landscape of prostate cancer. Because what we've discovered is actually, even though we've lumped prostate cancer as a single disease, it is actually made up of many different types of mutations that can occur, and each individual prostate cancer patient's cells are actually quite different. So in a large, multi-year, decade-long study that Dr. Small and Dr. Fang have led, we have been biopsying patients, taking biopsies from their tissue sites, their bone metastasis, their lung metastasis, et cetera, their prostates, and also doing liquid biopsies to try to interrogate using these types of technologies like whole genome sequencing and RNA sequencing to understand and define what are the changes that occur in cancer cells. And doing this, we've actually, our group here has published a number of different publications. These have actually set the standard for understanding these transcriptomic and omic changes in cancer cells, in prostate cancer cells specifically. Okay. So some of the mutations that we've identified are mutations that can be inherited and passed from one generation to another generation. Okay. And this is important to understand because these are mutations that might increase the cancer risk of not only that patient, but their siblings and also any biological children. So this was a study that was published almost 8-9 years ago now, where they took a look at all the omic information that was out there and asked what percent of prostate cancer patients actually have a mutation in a type of gene called a DNA repair gene. And what they found across these 7 studies was that almost 12% of patients, regardless of if they had a family history, actually had a mutation in one of these DNA repair genes. And if you take a look at the pie chart of what these DNA repair genes were, it was actually a huge surprise to the field at the time that almost half of the patients, 44% of the patients who had a mutation, in a gene called BRCA2 or BRCA2. Now, why was this a surprise? This is because this initial gene, breast cancer associated gene number 2, was thought to only affect women and increase their risk for breast cancer. And now what we've seen since that paper was published is that there is actually quite a sizable proportion of patients who also have this exact same mutation. Now, this mutation changes the counseling that family members should get, because if this patient had a biological daughter, they should be also screened for this BRCA mutation, which would change their mammography screening guidelines, potentially ovarian cancer screening guidelines. And if they had any biological sons, then it would be important to understand when should their son start PSA testing, okay? Not only does this gene increase risk for breast and prostate cancers, but you also need skin screening, you know, because these patients also have an increased risk for developing melanoma. So when we identify patients now with a BRCA mutation, we actually have a hereditary cancers clinic here at UCSF where we will send the patients and they will get the patient connected to the right dermatologist to do these annual skin screenings, which is so important in terms of their overall care. So those were mutations that can be transmitted from one generation to another, but there's also mutations that we call acquired mutations. So these are mutations. So remember, when you were born, you get a set of genes from that was a mix from your biological mom and dad. But over your lifetime, you can develop additional mutations, right? We are exposed to different kinds of DNA damage during our lives, things from like the sun, things from like what we eat, things from other sources of radiation, cigarette smoke, et cetera. And those external factors, those environmental factors can also change our DNA. These are mutations that are only in the cancer cells, meaning you cannot pass these to your kids, but are also important in terms of affecting your treatment. This is actually a study that we did here, published in Cell almost 6 years ago now. And the details of this are not important, but what I would like to just mention is that every single column is a patient, and every single row is a different gene that we've interrogated here. And the things that I want to have you appreciate today is that if you take a look at every single column, what you'll see is across the columns, no two patients are the same. So we see that there are some mutations that are common amongst these patients. So almost a half of the patients had a mutation in this gene called ERG, which is actually the focus of one of our other medical oncologists here, Dr. Bose, who studies this in the lab. But there's also a smattering of other mutations that are not shared. So we need to understand both the shared mutations and the unshared mutations in terms of how do they contribute to prostate cancer. And what I hope you appreciate from this chart is that in essence, what I'm trying to tell you is that the building blocks of each person's prostate cancer are very different, okay? Because the genes that make up the mutations in the cancer cells are very different. And what we need to do is understand this so that we can figure out how to best recommend treatments for our patients. So I'm going to give you one example of using that information, all that sequencing information to change and think about changing management. So this is actually a study that Dr. Fang published almost 8 years ago now, where he looked at a Decipher score specifically developed for understanding radiation benefits and lack thereof. And what he saw was that if you had a low genomic score, patients who got radiation, who did not get radiation, or who got radiation in blue and red, respectively, really had the same outcomes, okay? But patients who had a high score on this particular test, if they got radiation, you can see the flattening of that red line, which means they had fewer cancer-associated events in the future, meaning these were the patients who benefited from radiation. So this is one example of trying to use that kind of omic information to change patient care. I think we just heard about another one in terms of toxicity. In terms of trying to identify an Achilles heel, we now know for those patients who have those BRCA mutations that I mentioned a few slides ago, that there is a very specific type of therapy that our cancer center director, Dr. Ashworth, actually discovered about 15, 20 years ago. And that is to use a class of drugs called PARP inhibitors specifically for patients with BRCA mutations. This was the initial study that was published almost 10 years ago now, in which you saw that patients who had a BRCA mutation in blue versus patients who did not have a BRCA mutation here in red, that their response to this specific therapy was almost double. So 14 months of response compared to 7 months of response. So what this tells us is that there are certain subsets of patients where you might want to think about putting this particular medication, this PARP inhibitor, into their treatment plan. And for the patients who don't have this mutation, not incorporating it because they don't respond as well, and you should find something that they might respond better to. Over the last 8-9 years, so this initial study on the left here was only about 40 patients. Hundreds of patients have now received PARP inhibitors as part of their prostate cancer care. And again, that exact same trend holds true. And I apologize, in this particular study, they reversed the red and the blue. So it's a little bit confusing, but the patients who got the PARP inhibitor, in this particular case, it was a PARP inhibitor called talazoparib, with the addition of enzalutamide or Xtandi, these patients did a lot better if they had a BRCA or BRCA-like mutation. And this was just published last year. And this is now affecting the way that we are screening patients when at the time that they come into our medical oncology clinic, and also the treatments that they should go on in terms of their sequence. Okay, I'm going to end with the final these final few slides on trying to understand how do the proteins change on prostate cancer cells. And we know that from the DNA to the RNA, proteins that are expressed on the surface of prostate cancer cells, like PSMA, can also be affected. So we are trying to identify what these proteins are, because as you many of you probably know, we're trying to find drugs that will specifically latch on to those surface proteins. Similarly, very similar to how PSMA and Pluvicto might work, PSMA lutetium. And so with the biopsies that we've generated from men with advanced prostate cancer, we can actually stain for proteins like PSMA, which is shown in brown here, or other proteins like DLL3 that we're trying to discover. So in this particular biopsy, for example, this is a patient who had no brown staining, meaning negative in PSMA, but had a lot of brown staining in another surface protein called DLL3. So this is a patient who would not likely benefit from a PSMA-targeted therapy like Pluvicto, PSMA lutetium, but may benefit from a DLL3 targeting therapy. And so to get kind of show you that, and this is an image taken from the lab, the cancer cells are here in red, and the therapy that we're talking about is added. And what you're seeing is a swarm of immune cells to kill the DLL3 expressing red cells. So this type of therapy is now being evaluated in the setting of clinical trials, not only for prostate cancer patients, but also for lung cancer patients and other cancer types, something that Dr. Agarwal here is actually co-leading. So I'm going to end with this slide to kind of sum it all together. We are heavily invested and trying to understand the molecular profiles of each individual patient's tumor through these multiple different types of advanced testing that we can do now. And by identifying and doing this testing, people with prostate cancer go from gray, so everyone's the same, to knowing specific mutations that each patient might have. And the whole goal of understanding what mutations each patient's tumor might harbor is so then we can actually tailor a specific therapy for that patient. So if you have a mutation in the blue gene, we should maybe put you on a therapy for those patients. Compared to a patient with the pink gene, like a BRCA gene, we should put you on a PARP inhibitor. So this is sort of the whole, the holy grail of what we call precision oncology, identifying, going from action or going from observation of what the mutations are into action. Obviously, this takes a huge team to do. And so we've been very fortunate here at UCSF to have a fantastic prostate cancer team that Dr. Small alluded to, and just to show some of the people who are going to be here today that you probably know well. So with that, I thank you for your attention. Thank you to patients and your families for being here today, and I am happy to take questions.
Thanks, John. I'm going to hand out the microphone. A lot of questions. I have to say, I'm not sure I know anyone else who would show for their, you know, home movies pictures of swarming immune cells. So, but I'm not at all surprised, John.
Thank you very much. It was very informative. My question is, if each individual has a complete different or maybe semi different DNA map and DNA mutation, how you can do clinical trials for intervention, because every person is different than the other.
That is a great question.
How you guys will deal with precision medicine?
Because
the cohort is single, individual.
So that's a fantastic question. And I'll just repeat the question just in case people online couldn't hear that. And the question is, you know, if every individual prostate cancer is different, how do we do clinical trials? Because we're lumping everyone together. So I think, you know, what I would say is the pre-precision oncology era, what we were really trying to understand is what makes all prostate cancers the same. And that's how we have been testing the majority of our therapies. So for example, we know that the number one driver for prostate cancer is the androgen receptor, or AR. And so all the therapies that, medical therapies that we've developed over the last 20, 30 years have been focused on targeting that common pathway. So I'm not saying that prostate cancers don't have things in common, right? They certainly do. Okay, just like you and me have things in common, but we also have things that are very different between us. So I think we are now moving to trying to understand not only the things that are common across all prostate cancers, but also the things that are different. Now, in relation to your second question, well, how do we conduct clinical trials? So that's a great question. We are now doing trials where we are selecting based on the genomics, what patients can enter and what patients cannot enter. There's a bigger question about how we're going to address the disparities between that. But this paradigm of only testing the drug for a certain subclass of patients has been extremely effective for other cancers. So for example, melanoma with a certain kind of mutation, lung cancer with a certain subset of mutations, okay? And so we are trying to do the exact same thing, trying to understand the things that one particular patient might respond to, but one particular prostate cancer patient might not, but also developing the therapies that hopefully everybody can also respond to, so identifying the commonality. So PSMA, for example, is a great example where the majority of prostate cancers express PSMA. So that's why Pluvicto, PSMA lutetium, is approved for the majority of patients who have PSMA expressing prostate cancer. And then trying to understand for those who don't, what is out there for those patients.
I actually have two questions. One very specific related to what you just described about PSMA, that PSMA staining versus DLL3 staining, is it also used because of that for diagnosis, right? Because right now PSMA is mainly used, but based on that slide, many patients, or at least some patients, will not show cancer on PSMA. So that's one question one. And quickly, question two, you showed those three major goals. One of the things I didn't see there explicitly, I'm wondering, is it hidden somewhere already in one of the three, is are there any genetic indication of, in case of metastasis, in which direction, what organs most likely will be impacted?
So two questions. For the first question is about PSMA and whether or not we incorporate that specific type of testing right now in our clinical care. So we are very lucky for PSMA because we actually have a PET scan, a PSMA PET scan that's been developed by Dr. Carroll and others here, Dr. Hope, to be able to detect and measure PSMA in the entire body. And so we use the PET scan in order to try to select the patients who we think will do the best on a PSMA targeting therapy. We need more PET scans. So we need like a DLL3 PET scan that we and others at Memorial have been thinking about. So we need to develop PET scans to understand the entire patient. So when you biopsy a tumor, it's both great and also not great, right? Because you only get one sample. Let's say a patient might have two or three or even more areas. You don't get to biopsy because most patients don't like to have needles stuck into them in multiple places, right? And so you only get a sampling of one piece of tissue, one site. And so the PET scan, what that allows us is to actually take a bird's eye view of what is going on in the disease. So the second question that you mentioned was, thinking about how to incorporate this into kind of more general care, is that right?
Genetic
indication
of potential direction
So we don't have a clinically approved test that will tell us and help us predict if it's going to be lymph node, bone, or other organs. And so, you know, right now what we have the Decipher that just says you have a high risk or a lower risk of developing metastasis, but we're not at that fine detail. And so that would be sort of the next goal, would be try to understand what are the signatures that might predict organ-tropic types of metastasis.
So great questions. I'll jump in on both of them. This is, Dr. Chow is absolutely right. This is sort of the forward-looking piece, but a central part of our research program based on all these biopsies that we obtain is to learn what are the surface molecules that are common in prostate cancer. So PSMA is one, DLL3 is one. That's the first step, and that can be done from biopsies and so forth. The second is to develop imaging. So you get the PSMA PET scan, you get a John Chow marker PET scan, whatever, and we're very fortunate at UCSF that we have probably the world's best imaging group, not just in looking at the cancer, but developing those probes. So we have an active program that, you know, we discovered this marker called CD46, which you'll be hearing about from Dr. Agarwal. We are now developing and have developed and testing in patients a PET scan against CD46 because we also have a molecule that targets CD46's treatment. So you'll hear more about this later today, the field of so-called theranostics. Thera stands for therapy, gnostics, diagnostics. And so we identify a protein. The diagnostic piece is we can see it with a PET scan. The therapeutic part is that we develop a targeted therapy. And the targeted therapies are developing dramatically. It used to be that all we could really do is take an antibody and link radiation to it, which works, as in PSMA lutetium. But you can also link a toxin to it. And even more exciting, and you'll hear about this, John is doing some of this work, is that you can engineer these antibodies so that they engage T cells, immune cells. And so you identify a marker, and now the therapeutic grabs the same marker, but brings in the immune system. So it's absolutely transforming the field, and you're going to be hearing a lot about that in the next year or two. Matt?
On that note, there's a question from one of the live Zoom participants. For individualized precision therapy, just like this, what's the cost going to be?
Yeah, so the question is about individualized precision therapy. What is the cost going to be? I am definitely not an expert in that field, so I am going to completely defer that to the experts there. You know, but what I would say is that if we take a look at other cancers, lung cancer specifically, where they at the time of diagnosis, extensively profile the tumor. And based on that information, you go down of one of like eight different pathways in terms of your treatment. It can be done and it should be done.
So NCCN guidelines, the national guidelines that we participate in now, allow for biopsies of prostate cancer metastases, typically once they're hormonally resistant. If it shows up in NCCN guidelines, most insurance companies will support it. So that addresses that. The theranostic piece you'll be hearing later about clinical trials and so forth, you have to do the trial and get it FDA approved to do it. In the meantime, on the investigational side, you know, we absorb the cost as part of a study, but it can be quite expensive. One other thing, we're going to have to move on, but the one other comment I want to make in response to your question about location is that our group has, in fact, been looking at the genomics within the cancer. Is there something, if we take a look at all 50 or 100 liver metastases that we have, is there something in common in all of those that isn't found in patients that have lymph node metastases? It's complicated work to dissect that out, but it is ongoing, and we'll have hints at that. And then, you know, obviously, if you identify it, that becomes both diagnostic and hopefully in the future therapeutic. Great. Thank you, Dr. Chow.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.